Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, there's a Bible study by Michael Pellett, and he will be studying Resurrection, Do You Get It?, based on the book of Mark. So let's listen in on Michael.
Our last session here that I'll be teaching on the Gospel of Mark and Mark's understanding of discipleship is with the resurrection narrative. And how does one understand the resurrection in the Gospel of Mark? And what does it tell us about discipleship? Again, that's kind of everything we're reading in Mark's Gospel this week. I'm looking at it through that lens of discipleship. And what does Mark tell us about what it means to be a follower of Jesus? And so we'll look here at the ending of Mark's Gospel. And as I've listed up here, I think we need to look at Mark chapter 15, verse 40 through 16, verse 8. The resurrection account itself is just chapter 16. But I think to understand the whole resurrection, again, to look at Mark as a literary piece, that piece is this section of the Gospels, and it functions as an epilogue. In many respects, the punchline to Mark's Gospel, where he wants to get us to, is 1539. If you would look at that, it's the last thing that happens on the cross. Right? In verse 39 we read, "Now when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, 'Truly, this man was God's son.'" We've gone full circle. Mark 1:1 said, "The beginning of the gospel of Jesus the Christ, the Son of God." And that's what tipped us off from the very beginning and made us smart disciples. We knew who Jesus was. But now, if you follow Jesus all the way through the Gospels, through his Galilean ministry, through his journey to Jerusalem, through that last week in Jerusalem and on to the cross, now on the cross, having followed all of that, you can again say, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." Right? It brings it together. So 15:13 links us back up with 1:1. Right? We've come full circle. And in that sense, we've reached the climax of the gospel, and it could end there. But it doesn't. And one reason it doesn't, one reason we need an epilogue, is to say, well, a little more still has to happen. And again, usually an epilogue, right, kind of whether we're talking fairy tales or whatever, usually an epilogue tries to give us a quick little summary of how they lived happily ever after. Right? And sometimes I think as Christians, we like to look at the resurrection stories in that kind of nostalgic, sentimental way to say, oh yeah, it was the cross, but now Jesus is risen from the dead, and it means what? We can all live happily ever after. But that's not the way Mark is going to write an epilogue and end the story. We're going to look here at how Mark does it. Right? As the epilogue comes into focus, he introduces us now to a whole new group of disciples. He introduces us to the women. And in some senses, we can say Mark has saved the best for last. Because, right, what has happened to the men disciples? What's happened to the 12?
They've scattered.
They've denied Jesus. They've betrayed Jesus. They have followed, and when they did, only out of fear. I mean, they're certainly not the paradigm for discipleship. Right? The men have let us down. The 12 have let us down. They're rocky ground. So, right, are there any other candidates for discipleship? Yes, there are. There are the women. Right? And so in verse 40, there were also women looking on from a distance. Okay? Right. But already there's that kind of ambiguity that Mark loves. Right. Kind of good news, bad news. There were also women looking on. Whew, right? The good news is to say, right, there still were some faithful folks around, right? The men, the 12 and others, have all deserted and left. But there's still some people who have kept on following Jesus through this time of suffering and crisis, right? Even on the cross, where Peter and Judas and James and John and Andrew and all the others have deserted and left, there's still some looking on, still following, but the bad news, from a distance. So again, we've got that contrast working there of faithful and fearful discipleship, right? The fear is seen, right, from a distance. They're holding back. They're not following Jesus as closely as one would think, right? Or one would hope. But it's still, they're looking on. And so for us again is the reader to say, well, you know, there's some hope here with these women that there's faithful discipleship and we can keep that alive. And again, as characteristic for Mark, when we are talking about disciples who follow, who have been called, they are also named. And so here too, we have the names, right? Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James the younger, and of Joses and Salome. And again, now these characteristics, right? These used to follow him. Okay, so just like all the other disciples, like the other 12, they used to follow him. And what else is noted about them? And provided for him when he was in Galilee. And that notion of provided for him, again, is the word diakonos that Mark likes to use a lot in terms of, right, they served him. Or, right, in Holdenese, these were the waitri. Right? These were the people who, again, assisted Jesus in helping others. And also assisted Jesus by helping Jesus. To make sure that as he's going about his ministry, right, I mean, who makes sure that he gets food and is taken care of and is welcomed and received? These women did. So that these women, again, positively personify the two key understandings of discipleship that Mark has talked about all along. First and foremost, following Jesus. And secondly, right, being the servant, the slave, the deacon, the waitri to all. That's what they did. So again now, right, our hopes, right, on the old hope scale, right, our hopes are rising. Because you say, oh good, these women are exactly what disciples are supposed to be about. So there's hope here. Right? And again, the third part of this, right, the women who had come up with him to Jerusalem, again, to accentuate the following, right, come up with him. That sense that, you know, they've been following Jesus all along, throughout his ministry, just like the men had, just like the 12. So we've got a good sense of disciples. Now there's again a break, and there's an interlude here between verses 42 to 46. And we talk about Joseph of Arimathea and the burial. And what do we have to say about Joseph? When evening had come, since it was the day of preparation, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a respected member of the council, okay, he's a respected member of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish religious leaders group. So he's that respected member, and what else? Who was also himself waiting expectantly for the kingdom of God. Let me summarize that in just the one word. He exhibits piety. Right? He's a pious person that waiting for, does what? Goes boldly to Pilate, ask for the body. And again, Pilate wonders if Jesus was dead, figures that out, notes that the body is dead, gives it to Joseph and says, sure, bury him. Joseph buries him in a tomb, puts the rock in front of it. Okay. The other thing here is, yes, Joseph is a respected member of the council. He exhibits piety, but at least in Mark again, there's that interesting ambiguity. Right? Is Joseph an opponent or a follower of Jesus? Now remember, we're reading Mark's gospel, not John. If we read the gospel according to John, Joseph of Arimathea is kind of an incognito follower. Right. But what about in Mark's gospel?
No
Yeah, but weren't there a lot of folks who weren't following Jesus who were also waiting for the kingdom? Right? A lot of other pious, God-fearing people? I mean, that's a positive statement in that sense. Mark isn't trying to put Joseph down, but is he a follower or an opponent?
He's named,
yeah, but so is Pilate.
I've always interpreted him as being a follower, I guess, or part of it. I don't follow her, but if that's the right, but he honored Jesus in a sense by honoring the body of Jesus. Wasn't touching a dead body supposed to be unkosher?
Right, that would make you unclean. But again, here we don't know if Joseph himself takes the body down, or again, right, given that he'd be on the Jewish council and a respected member, he has bucks, he can get slaves to do the job. So he can protect his own purity and cleanliness.
So we don't know.
Okay.
We just don't know.
Or I'm gonna be bold here and say, I think Mark understands Joseph basically as an opponent of Jesus. And that this is put in here again to shame the disciples. I'll tell you why. First of all, chapter 14, verses 55 and 64. As Mark recounts Jesus' trial in front of the Jewish council, he wants to note that in 55 he used in English, or at least the New Revised Standard Version, is to think the whole council seeks to condemn him, and in 64 they all voted to put him to death. Now, if we take that with utmost seriousness, If Joseph is a member of that council, Joseph then, if it's all, if it's unanimous, Joseph also voted, hand him over to Pilate, kill him. Now we can get into intentions. Did he do that because he was just an absolute coward and then he saved his skin? Well, that's not too complimentary either, is it? But just to put it this way, I think, again, radical kind of guy that Mark is, to put him as the opponent is again to say, right, look at the 12 and the cowards they are. They don't even have the decency to come out and bury their leader. Right? An enemy, an opponent of Jesus, who at least has common decency because he has a sense of piety, right? He at least fears God, right, and wants to keep the Sabbath rules, has the decency to take this man off the cross and bury him. Right. I think another reason that Joseph is the opponent and Mark wants it in that way is to contrast it with the disciples of John the Baptist. In Mark's gospel, John the Baptist is beheaded by Herod, and to be a follower of the Baptist can also be risky business and put your life into jeopardy. But what we read is that what? The disciples of John the Baptist, hearing that he had been beheaded, come and bury the body. Right. Again, even John the Baptist gets a respectable burial by his followers. Jesus doesn't even get that. Right. Again, to show the depths of desertion and denial, the depths of fearful discipleship. Right? Peter, James, John, Andrew don't even come out of hiding to bury Jesus. That's how bad it is. Again, to set that contrast. This morning in the first class, someone also suggested, and I have to think about this some more, but saying, oh yeah, and also this opponent thing, they even kind of upped the ante on the opponent and said, and yeah, I mean, Joseph did this out of decency, but maybe even Joseph, again, you know, in that sense about, you know, putting it in a rock tomb and putting a great big heavy stone against the door, right? Joseph, too, had heard all these rumors about this Jesus guy going to be raised on the third day and saying, well, you know, when those kinds of things go around, the disciples might steal the body and then, you know, claim resurrection. So, you know, to be sure that that doesn't happen, I'm going to take care of the body and I'll put it in the safest tomb I know and put the biggest stone I've got in front of it so that they can't get Jesus. They can't get to Jesus' body. I mean, that's even putting the opponent side much higher even than I thought of. Yes?
In verse 47 it says they took note of where he was laid as if Joseph did it in secrecy.
Mm-hmm. It could be, or again, it's that notion, right, the women taking note of it, right? The good news is they're still faithful, they're following all the way through to the burial, but again, only from a distance. Right? So it could be that Joseph is doing it in secrecy, or again, I think at least for Mark, what I feel more confident in saying is, again, it notes the dualism between faithfulness and fearful, right? The good news is they still keep following. The bad news is it's still always from a distance. Right? But they do note where the body is laid.
You'd also think that the resurrection, our confidence in the resurrection is based on women going to the wrong tomb. So if they took note,
right.
They went to the right tomb.
Right. That's another point to say, right, the women know where the body is. Right. So there's no mistakes. There's no confusion in that again, as others would want to disclaim the resurrection. Oh, they went to the wrong tomb. No, again, that they know precisely where the body is. That's right. It shows that. And that's now what Mark will pick up on. Right, see where the body is, and then when the Sabbath is over, we come back to the women. Right, so now again, our hopes are there. And so in verse 1, when the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. Okay, so we have the women buying spices. Now, is that good news or bad news? Are our hopes going up when we read that, or are our hopes going down?
Down.
Down? Okay. Why are your hopes going down when you read about spices?
Well, because they're embalming or whatever.
Okay, because sometimes spices are used for embalming. Does Mark say they're using spices for embalming? No. But that's okay. We know they use spices for embalming. And the other Gospels, like Luke, specifically say they're doing that for embalming the body. And so if you read, they bought spices for embalming, that's right. Your hopes go down. They didn't get it. All right. But what else does one use spices for?
To anoint?
To anoint whom or what?
Kings.
Kings. So, right, again, I think Mark's wonderful ambiguity at the, right, our hopes could go up to say, oh, they did get it. Right? They want to get the front seat for the coronation. Because remember, they've been following Jesus all along. They've heard his passion predictions that he's going to go to Jerusalem, suffer, die, but then, right, and on the third day, rise again. So it's what? Third day. It's rise again time. Wouldn't you want to be out there with your spices to anoint King Jesus at the resurrection? Of course, right? Ah, maybe they got it. So again, right, Mark kind of keeps our tension going, you know, keeps our curiosity going. Are they going to embalm or are they going to coronate? Right, that's, and so we're not, and so verse 2, very early on the first day of the week when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb? Okay, now when you read verse 3, how is your hope meter running? Down. Right. Because they're talking about what? Rolling away the stone. And so if they're talking about rolling away the stone, they must be talking about, given these two options, which one?
Embalming.
They didn't get it. Right? The thing again, and perhaps a little, although the word here for stone is not the same one as rock, but we may want to think again about stones and rocks and that and say, yeah, it's kind of rocky, isn't it? They're stumbling over the stone. It's the biggest stone of all that they're stumbling over, right? That stone of death, that stone of the cross. But, right, it seems now again that rather than the women being seen as faithful disciples, they too seem that even their following was out of fear, right? And what they're trying to do now is just kind of make the best of it and bring to closure what they had hoped for, right? So our hopes are pretty low. Then verse 4, right? They looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, They saw a young man dressed in a white robe, and again, for Mark, the understanding of white connotes a notion of divinity or of divine kind of being, heavenly being. Remember the transfiguration. Everything was white. Jesus appeared white. So there was some kind of, you know, we have here, right, a young man dressed in a white robe. We sometimes say, see, look, an angel. Or at least what Mark is indicating here. We do have a heavenly messenger, right? And sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed, right? They were, again, this kind of astonished, amazed, right? Terrified. Right? Again, what's going on here? Seeing this kind of heavenly being. And the this messenger says, using the same word again, don't be alarmed, or stop being alarmed. Right. And then announces the good news. Right? You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. Okay? So we can... We can say that in many respects, with regard to the resurrection story, is as Mark relates it. Chapter 16, verse 6, is the key understanding of the resurrection in terms of here's what the good news is, right? That Jesus is not here. And that not here, again, testifies to what? That God's salvific will has definitively been carried through. Right. Because, again, it was the human forces of opposition to God and to Jesus that wanted to put and place Jesus here. But he's not here. So their will wasn't carried through. God's will is carried through. Right? The promise that God made has now been kept. And so we again can be assured that God, the promise maker, is God, the promise keeper. And so following this God and this Jesus and his ways is also the way to go. It is the way of promise. Promises made and kept. Right. That Jesus is not here again. Jesus cannot be entombed and held by death or any other kind of human authority, power, evil. Right. God can be trusted. God's reign and rule is indeed the way of living in the world. And we can orient ourselves to that. Right. That's all there, I think, in the not here. Given that, right? Given that now, again, for Mark's setup, right, this is what we are hearing. This is what these women are hearing. Not here. God's promises have been kept. Given that hearing, now comes the speaking or the action. The heavenly messenger tells the women to what? Go and tell. A typical mark and pattern for discipleship. Hearing leads to speaking. Hearing leads to acting. And so again, having heard that good news of God's promise, of God's plan, of God's reign and rule, right? Go, tell. And two things, right? That Jesus is going ahead of you, and we'll come back to this, but I want to note this phrase again because it's important. Going ahead of you and to Galilee. And so they do that, and again, there you will see him. just as he told you. Again, the point here being that this heavenly messenger isn't saying anything new. Right? He's just simply saying what Jesus has been saying all along. So we have that. Okay, now to kind of continue the narrative. Right? The angel says, go tell. And now we see that the women, right, so they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. The angels say, go tell, and the women, right, flee and say nothing. Did they get it? No. Right? Where is the old hope meter? Right? They didn't get it. What are we going to do now? The 12 didn't get it. Right? They're hiding out somewhere. Right? They don't even have enough guts to come out and bury their dead leader. That's how bad that is. I mean, that's our hope there has gone to outright humiliation and disgust for them. The women, who seem to be portrayed at first as even better disciples than at a distance, it was there was some hope left. Finally, they end up not as disgustingly as the men, but certainly as disappointingly, right? Instead of go tell, they flee and say nothing. Who's left? Who are the candidates now for discipleship?
Us.
How can it be us?
Because we can get it.
How could we get it? We go and tell, but what makes you think that we could get it?
Because we've heard everything that he has said.
Yeah. We've heard it. I mean, remember, right, as listeners or readers to this story, who else has been following along throughout Jesus' Galilean ministry? Who else has been following along in his journey to Jerusalem and heard all of his teachings about discipleship? Who else has been witnessing that final week in Jerusalem all the way through his suffering and death? And even, if you will, albeit from a distance, has witnessed to that crucifixion and burial. And now we too have heard that good news of promise and the command. And the final answer and the final question is, do you get it? Well?
Yes?
Yes? No? I mean, for Mark, right, that's where the gospel ends. Right? I mean, that question is, right, we've gone through the 12. They weren't very good candidates for discipleship. We've gone through the women who had better promise. But finally, so, right, who are the only candidates left for discipleship now? You are. Do you get it? Well, right, in that sense, you could say, to be continued. Right? So my hope meter again is at least running. I don't know if it's going up or going down, right? But I've got to, right? There's still a chance for the old hope meter here. Do you? And that's, I think, right. That's precisely where Mark wants it to be. That's, I mean, again, You know, there's enough scholarship on the crazy way Mark ends his gospel that you could sit down for a whole year and read articles and books and dissertations on it. And why does he leave it so open-ended? I think it's very purposeful, and I think he leaves it open-ended precisely because, again, the challenge to discipleship, and precisely again because that to be continued, right, leads us to examine ourselves and our lives and our orientation as followers of Jesus to say, well, like the 12, like the women, we too now confront that challenge of, is ours a discipleship of fear, or is it a discipleship of faith? We too now, again, having heard God's promise, having seen that promise in the resurrection, having gotten God's command, go tell, faithful discipleship will carry that through, or the discipleship of fear, like the 12, like the women, will flee and say nothing. Do you get it? That's it. Now, a little more. Back to these phrases. Right. The word there that Jesus is going ahead of you. Again, for Mark, that's a key phrase. Mark used that phrase over and over again for Jesus' Galilean ministry and particularly for Jesus' journey to Jerusalem. That what? Jesus was always going ahead of the disciples, and they were what? Following. So that again, do we get it? Do we go and tell? It's not that we must go alone, but that what? Jesus is always going ahead of us. Jesus, again, right? The good news of the resurrection is Jesus is again leading us. Will we follow? All right, that's the question. Will we follow? And will that following be one of fear or one of faith? Again, Mark isn't going to make a judgment about that or anything. Mark presents us with that challenge, presents us with that open-ended question, because, of course, the way that is answered is the way you live your lives as followers of Jesus. He can't answer that question for you. That's how you live your lives. All Mark can do, right, is again reassure us with that promise, witness to God's reign and rule, say, you know, you've heard it all. You know what God says and what God does and how God has carried through on that. Right? Now it's, do you get it? So that's the sense again of going ahead, and going ahead of you to Galilee. Why do you think Galilee? What does Galilee mean for Mark? Anybody, since many of you have been following here for this week, or what would Galilee mean for Mark? And is, you know, Mark's gospel, you know the gospels in general, to kind of help. Why would Mark want to say going ahead to Galilee? What's in Galilee? What's so good or not so good about Galilee?
Home territory.
It's home?
Everyday life.
So that to go back to Galilee means to go back home, back to the everyday life. It's back to that notion that we have sometimes talked about, is where is discipleship? Wherever we are. It's the here. Where am I to practice my discipleship? Here. And, you know, wherever there are my mothers and brothers and sisters. Right? And so to go to Galilee is to go to your heres, wherever that might be, right? Wherever your lives are. And that's where you practice discipleship. So going to Galilee is to say, yes, Jesus is again leading you to your homes, to your everyday lives. And that's where you practice faithful discipleship. That's where you are followers. What else does Galilee mean?
That's where they were fishing.
That's where they were fishing. Okay, so that's part of their everyday life again, their occupation, their fishing, and that's where they are followers.
That's where he started.
That's where he called them.
That's where he started. Okay, it's the place of calling. It's where they started. It's back to the beginning. Anything else about Galilee? What did Jesus do in Galilee?
First miracle.
It was the first miracle, or let's just generalize that. Galilee is specifically where Jesus does his ministry. This was the place of his preaching, teaching, healing, right? All of that. The journey to Jerusalem, right? In Mark's gospel, there weren't as many healings and all of that. It was much more emphasis on, you know, preaching, teaching and that. But in terms of Mark's, this in Galilee is where Jesus was in the full practice of his ministry. So for us to go back to Galilee is to say, right, you go back to your places where ministry is to be done. Going to Galilee is to go to our places of preaching, teaching, healing, wherever.
Just to amplify that, 1:14 and 15. Mm-hmm. Now after John was arrested, Jesus came into Galilee, mm-hmm. preaching the gospel of God and saying, the time is fulfilled, the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel. The whole thing of gospel and good news.
All right. The kingdom, the reign of God is at hand. So we go back to those places where, right, God's reign and rule is at hand, is working, right? Because when we engage, wherever that here might be, wherever we engage in that ministry, that is where the gospel is working. The gospel is at hand, right? So to go to Galilee is again an invitation to say, participate in bringing in that gracious rule of God, that gospel that's right at hand, that's imminent. Okay. What else?
It's also where the Jews and Gentiles are living together or near to each other.
Okay.
Cosmopolitan area.
That's right. It's a group, I've kind of labeled it, right? It's a group of the insiders and the outsiders. Right? It's a group of all sorts of people, right? We'll be real technical, right? It's a mixed bunch, right? And that what? Part of the understanding from the Galilean ministry is that those who we thought were insiders are really outsiders, and those who we thought were outsiders are really insiders, and that God's reign and rule wants to what? Incorporate everybody, include everyone. And so to go back to Galilee is to go back to that mixed bunch and tell everyone that God's reign and rule, that God's promises are for them.
Going back to the fishing, he'd already told them when he called them that he would make them fishers of men.
Right. Right.
So that again, this links fishing both in terms of everyday lives and to that sense of ministry. What else is in Galilee? Who or what did Jesus confront in Galilee?
The demons.
The demons, yeah. He confronts the demons. He confronts illness of all kinds. He confronts opposition. We'll use another technical term here. Bad stuff. I mean, on the one hand, again, part of the irony is, yeah, Galilee is home, and there was ministry and kingdom of God, but where that was coming about and being realized, it also means in Galilee, you know, to go back to Galilee is to go back to where the demons are still working, where illness is still abounding, where there is opposition to this word and this proclamation, where there is oppression and injustice and all sorts of other stuff contrary to the gospel and to God's will. And to kind of say, and you mean you want us to go back to all that? Yes. Right? That's what following Jesus means, right? That's why, in that sense, the resurrection story is not, and they lived happily ever after. The resurrection story is that it frees us up to what? Go back into that world where the demons dwell. Not in fear, but in faith. All right. The resurrection liberates us to confront all of this in Jesus' name, in God's name, and say, right, be silent, be gone, be cured, be made well, be made alive, be whole. Right? Remember all those pronouncements that Jesus said in these different situations. Now we say that. Right. We now, just like Jesus' ministry in Galilee, we carry on our ministries in Galilee. We go back to towns and cities and farms and where all of this stuff is there as well, right? We go back to all of the bad stuff, but as faithful followers. Right. It comes full circle. I want to say a little something too about the beginning, right? Galilee was the beginning. And so remember the way the gospel starts, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when we get to the resurrection, I think Mark wants to make it very clear. No, that's not the end of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Right? It's again that notion of, I erased it, to be continued. And how is it continued? It is continued because the resurrection takes us back to the beginning. We always go back to the beginnings. Starting anew, starting afresh, continuing that ministry in our places, wherever we are. Do you get it?
Yes.
You get it? All right, that's the question, in that sense of beginning. One more thing that I want to say about the resurrection, and I think what to try and explain a little bit why the women, right, fled in terror and fear and did not say anything to anyone. That again, we would say, oh, the resurrection, you would think that, you know, that's good news and you would be excited about that. But within the context of the literature of the time and elsewhere, there are other stories of other people being resurrected from the dead. And I don't know if you're familiar with these or not, but maybe to think about this. Most story, right, if someone is resurrected from the dead, or if someone comes back from the dead, what's their purpose? What do they do once they come back from the dead?
Get you,
right? I mean, usually within these stories, or you can even think about it, right, as ghost stories, right? What do ghosts do? Because, you know, of course, ghosts are one kind of species of being that comes back from the dead. What do? Haunt you. That's not very happy news, is it? And why do they haunt you? Because usually you've done something against them, right? That people are resurrected or people come back from the dead because they are seeking retribution and revenge. So now all of a sudden, these disciples of Jesus hear he's come back from the dead. Well, does that strike you as good news if you have just been involved in the betrayal, denial of Jesus? You've absolutely scattered and deserted him, and you are such cowards that you're not even willing to bury the body. You're going to say, oh, this guy's going to probably come back and give me a really warm hug, right? I mean, it's bad enough. He's dead. Now he's come back from the dead. Whew, we're toast. Right? He's going to get us, you know. Jesus is risen, and is he mad? Right? That's, if you will, I think, that's what the women are hearing. That's what the 12 initially are hearing. That again, resurrection is a word of retribution and revenge. And again, why this message here in verses 16 and 17 is such shocking good news gospel is that there's not a word of revenge in there, is there? Right? That Jesus is risen, not here, and what? Go tell the disciples and Peter. Go tell those betrayers, those deniers, those cowards, those jerks, right? We won't be nice to them, but go tell them what? Get on with the ministry. Right? Amazing, right? After all that they've done, Jesus is still willing to stick with them as his disciples, is still willing to say to them, yes, you are my followers. And although you've deserted me, I'm not deserting you. Let's get on with the ministry. Let's get on with proclaiming and enacting God's gracious reign and rule to all people. We've got a job to do. Let's get to work. Utterly amazing. Again, you would think, after all of this, Jesus, when are you going to smarten up, dump these guys, and get some good folks? The word to us, as we recognize our own rocky discipleship, our own discipleship of fear instead of faith, is that what? The word comes to us again and says, yeah, right? I know you folks. You're sometimes smart disciples, but as well, you sometimes are deserters and deniers and cowards and jerks. But hey, let's get on with the ministry. We've got work to do. God's gracious reign and rule is at hand. It needs to be proclaimed and enacted. Do you get it? Right? And so even there again, right? Neither does Jesus dump us and try to get a new crew. Right? But faithfully remains, keeps coming, assures, despite the kind of disciple we may be at times. Again, I think very good news, right? The resurrection is not retribution and revenge. Jesus is not coming back to get even. Jesus is coming back to empower and equip and make us, again, part of that gracious reign and rule of God. So, that's the way I understand Mark having something to say about the resurrection and linking that good news of the resurrection with the understanding of discipleship and how we, again, as disciples, live out that resurrection promise. Questions? Comments?
How many of us do you think would have been any different in the days of Christ and the disciples and been able to understand all of the statements he was making about his death and resurrection? When you read a lot of these in the Bible and you wonder how the disciples could have interpreted them, because, you know, there was nothing like this that ever happened before, and I'm afraid all of us, we'd have been there the same time the disciples would have been, as you call them, stupid disciples.
Sure. And I think, too, again, Mark is characterized, even here at the end, right? It's to be continued. You know, do you get it? It's, again, that sense to go back to the parable of the sower and the seed. What has Mark done? Mark has, again, sown that seed of the gospel to us. Now, right, what kind of soil are we? The path, the rocky ground, the weedy soil, the soils that bring forth abundant fruit, right? That's open, right? That's the open question. And in that sense, we as soil are no different than the soils of those disciples back then.
There's an excellent book in the bookstore on this, the Gospel of Mark. Building on this, I think what you've done, an excellent presentation of discipleship and the main thrust of Mark. But this book goes into the cultural, the political, the social, the economic dynamics that talk about what it means for Christ to go along that way and therefore for us. And the book's called Binding the Strong Man by Chad Myers. It's in the scriptural section of our bookstore over here. Weighty volume, but it just builds on what Michael's presented to us and gets at some of the things you're talking about, too.
Other comments? Reflections?
So much said whenever the book of Mark is being taught about his use of the word immediately. Has that got any?
I think part of that for Mark is, you know, he wants to keep the story moving, right? And so he can do it that way. Also for Mark, I think it functions in the sense that, right, the word, the gospel, the seed, always has results. Right? And those results, if you will, can happen right away. And some of those results can be negative results. But it's always that sense that for Mark, the gospel bears consequences. And that happens right away. Right, where the gospel is working, you can see what's happening. You can hear what's going on.
I have a comment. comment. In the challenge to be an everyday disciple, the thought that I had upon hearing all these things was that it seems so much like I like to have the notion in my mind that God is right where I'm at. And I think it's a neat reflection to think about that the way I'm reading this then is that the hearing part, that whenever there are things in our life or challenges in the ministry part at the bottom of the board, that it kind of goes back up to the top then. Well, you've heard it all. And even it kind of goes to the discerning ear too. So it's, I think that's a real challenge in ministry in general as modern day disciples. That knowing that Christ is ahead of us, but then Christ is also with us too and helps us to do that discerning. That's quite a comfort to me.
Mm-hmm. And going back to Galilee, back to the beginning, is also that sense of we go back and hear again and again and again. That's how Christ, again, one of the ways in which Christ is with us, right? Just listen. You can hear. He's with us. Well, the bell has rung, so I'm not going to keep you anymore. I want to thank you for your patience for the week, and those of you who were here and endured the week, and for your comments and thoughts, and I've learned some things from you and some new insights to think about, and I appreciate that. And I hope that you, too, will go back and think about Mark some more, and every now and then, just ask yourself the question, do I get it? Good. Thank you.
Thank you.